Welcome, everyone. I'm Steve Farrell, the Worldwide Executive Director for Humanities Team, and I'm super excited to be here with you for this free program. It's called The Key to Personal Empowerment and the Future of Human Civilization. This online program is with best-selling author and biologist Bruce H. Lipton, PhD. This is a 90-minute program with a 30-minute live Q&A at the end, so be sure to make note of questions that you have. I'll be coming back live to answer your questions after this initial program. This program is part of a free online video series with Bruce Lipton, Greg Braden, and Lynn McTaggart called Discover Why You Don't Need Technology to Take a Giant Leap Forward in Human Development. Thanks so much for joining us. We've got a really powerful program in store. As we get started, I'm going to give Bruce a proper introduction. Bruce H. Lipton, PhD, is an internationally recognized leader in bridging science and spirit. Stem cell biologist, best-selling author of The Biology of Belief, and recipient of the 2009 Goy Peace Award, he has been a guest speaker on hundreds of TV and radio shows, as well as keynote presenter for national and international conferences. In 1982, Dr. Lipton produced breakthrough studies on the cell membrane, which revealed that this outer layer of the cell was an organic homolog of a computer chip, the cell's equivalent of a brain. His research at Stanford University School of Medicine between 1987 and 1992 revealed that the environment operating through the membrane controlled the behavior and physiology of the cell, turning genes on and off. He is regarded as one of the leading voices of the new biology. And welcome to the program, Bruce. Great to be here with you.
Steve, I am so excited to be here with you, but more importantly with our wonderful audience out there, especially at this time of chaos in the world. There's a little order and sanity that can be seen here, and I hope we provide it.
Absolutely. That's right. There is a lot of challenge out there, and we're gonna definitely provide some sanity here and some vision around new possibilities. So Bruce, let's jump right in here. And before we go into the program with Bruce, I want to share that near the end of this program, we're going to tell you about a brand new 8-week masterclass that we've been working on for over a year. It's called Technology, Consciousness, and Evolution: Discover How to Unleash Your Ultimate Potential. Bruce, Greg Braden, and Lynn McTaggart are faculty for this program. This is the first time they've offered a masterclass together. Be sure to stay tuned for details. Now, let's jump right in with Bruce and get to the important topics that we planned for the hour. And Bruce, as we get started, can you share how the role of consciousness, according to the principles of quantum physics, plays a role in shaping life experiences?
Well, the first thing we have to understand, and this is the most important valid truth before we say the next thing, and that is quantum physics is the most truthful, accurate of all the sciences on planet Earth. There's no science that comes near the truth that is provided by quantum physics. And I said, well, understanding that, then we start with the first premise of quantum physics. And the first premise is consciousness is creating our life experience. Now, from a world of physics, it's like, what the heck does that mean? It's like the pictures in our mind are broadcast into the world, into the universe that we live in, and that our consciousness is shaping that reality in front of us. Now, of course, there's collective consciousness, which then shapes our general collective reality, but then we all also have our own personal consciousness that's affecting this. And then you go, wow, well, physics, you know, how does that connect to biology? And the answer is very important right here, because it turns out that the brain is translating the pictures in our mind. That's what the function of the brain is. See the pictures in your mind and then manifest a reality that accommodates that idea. That's why we live in a world that seems, yeah, I knew that was going to happen, or yeah, this is what I expected and all that. It's because it's not a chance, we are manifesting in front. So I say, well, that was really cool. But the interesting part for me was, as a biologist, the connection shows how the consciousness of the brain is translated into chemistry that goes through the body via the blood. So that the blood is not just providing nutrition, the blood provides information to the cells. So it's like hormones, neurotransmitters, emotional chemicals, whatever. This is information that the body is experiencing. And I say, so what's the relevance? I say, the chemistry of the brain is a complement to the picture in the mind. If you have a positive picture, you create positive chemistry. And if you have a negative picture, unfortunately, you create negative chemistry. The chemistry is a complement to the picture. I say, why is that relevant? Because the chemistry goes through the blood, and that chemistry is used to adjust the genetics and the behavior of our cells. And I go, oh my goodness, then the picture in the mind ultimately is the information translated by cells into genetics and behavior. And I go, absolutely. And then we start to understand them. Oh my goodness. And the consciousness, which is generating those pictures, is the primary element responsible for the character of our lives. And it's really hard for people to get a lot of this, especially the quantum physics part, because one of the most important facts of quantum physics that makes it quantum physics is that when we saw the world through the eyes of Newtonian mechanics, classical physics, we saw a world split into two realms, energy and matter, and that we're told that those two realms don't really interact with each other. So we've separated matter and energy, which separates body in science from consciousness, which is energy. So for years and years and years, science ignored the role of mind in biology, but inevitably had to face it when we started to understand about the nature of the placebo effect. And the placebo effect is very important to our question about consciousness and world right here, because basically what is the placebo effect, which is responsible for over a third or maybe up to two thirds of all medical healing, is placebo effect. I said, what is it? I go, well, you have an illness, a doctor comes up and says, look, I got this newest pill, greatest thing the pharmaceutical company has ever made. It's colored purple, so that's really, you know, really good. And I say, why is it relevant? I say, because this pill is going to heal you. And you take this pill with, oh my goodness, I've got this new drug. And then you get well, and then you find out the pill was a sugar pill. And he goes, well, the whole important story here is, what does that mean? And it means simply this: what healed you was not the pill. What healed you was the positive belief about the pill. And I said, so belief healed you, not the pill. And everyone goes, yeah, okay, I understand placebo effect. And I go, now what we need to add to this, is which is not talked about, and it's more important at this time, is placebo is a result of positive thinking. What is the consequence of negative thinking? I go, oh my God, it's equally powerful in shaping your life as is the positive thinking. And in medicine, negative thinking consequences are referred to as the nocebo effect. I go, what does that mean? I said, negative thinking can cause any disease in your body to manifest and can even kill you. Just the thought you're going to die with belief behind it, that will kill you. So the power is this. It's not whether it's positive belief or negative belief. The point is simply this. It's belief, which is consciousness, which ends up shaping the character of your life. And now biology and physics are saying the exact same story. So it really says, oh my goodness, this is a time to recognize your thoughts are not just passing through your head. Your thoughts are manifesting a life experience. And all of a sudden it says, then we should pretty much be concerned about what we're thinking these days.
Yeah, boy, and isn't that so important? Yeah, thank you, Bruce. So much important wisdom right now there. So let me throw this question at you. How can you free yourself from the limitations of four myth perceptions that have misprogrammed civilization into believing we are victims of our heredity? Maybe we can start by understanding the four myth perceptions.
Well, yeah, this is really critical, because if we just jump from the last question to this question, well, the last question conclusion was very simple. Your consciousness is creating your life experiences, with positive consciousness leading to a positive life and negative consciousness leading to death. And so the issue about it now, right now, is, so the question is, what if we bought beliefs that have shaped our consciousness and these beliefs are incorrect, and yet we've been creating a civilization based on incorrect beliefs? I go, listen, the more people that share a belief, the more powerful in manifesting that belief is. That's what we experience in the world. So when we have cultural beliefs that are wrong, then a massive number of people are having a very negative or a belief system that's not very supportive because of its inaccuracy and challenging us. And I say, okay, what are those? And you mentioned there are four of them. So let's just start off with the first one, which we briefly touched on in the first question, and that is the belief that we live in a universe of two realms, matter and energy, and they don't interact in such a way. That fell by the wayside 100 years ago when quantum physics revealed that everything is one thing. Everything is energy. And for this is where human civilization has a problem, is because you grow up in a world of this is physical and this is invisible and this, you know, like here are some radio waves. No, that's invisible stuff. And I say, here's the radio. And I say, oh, that's the physical part. And so we separate the universe like that. To come to this, and this is so critical, come to this reality that has been known for 100 years, that all of this is energy. This is an illusion. And I love it because Albert Einstein's quote is something to the effect that matter is an illusion, albeit a persistent one, that this material realm is not material, it's energy. And so without going into a lot more about it, I say, well, energy is shaping our world. This is a quote from Albert Einstein, a simple one. It says, the field, which is energy, the field is the sole governing agency of the particle, which is our illusion of matter. The invisible is shaping the material. I go, you know, this is ancient wisdom. It was called spirituality a long time ago. And it's interesting because the definition of spirit and the definition of quantum physics field are the same definition, that is invisible moving forces that influence the physical world. So today's quantum physics field and ancient spirituality are come together again. I say, why is it relevant? Because then the insights offered by spirituality are not accidents or coincidence. They're understandings of how our consciousness, the invisible field, is shaping this world. And yet we look at the world as a physical thing is affecting me, a physical chemical, a drug, whatever it is. I go, no, it's all energy and it's an illusion. The fact is consciousness is creating this and it's energy, and energy is shaping matter. So once we start to own this as truth, then all of a sudden people start to recognize the power of consciousness. You have to be very careful in one sense, because you don't realize your thoughts are being manifest into reality. And if you understood that, then all of a sudden you see how the whole world would change its thoughts from the fear-based world that we live into the thoughts of, oh my God, heaven on earth. Well, yeah, you can have that just as much as a fear-based world. It's our creation. That's number one. Number two is the belief that genes control our life, which most people have been programmed with. And I go, what's wrong with this assumption? And I go, well, besides that it's false, it generates a different consequence of who and what we really are. If we go by the old belief that genes control our life, then there's a simple question. It's like, did you pick the genes you came with? You go, no, as far as we know. Can you change the genes if you don't like the characteristics? Like, no, can't do that. And then we tell you that genes turn on and off by themselves, and then you start to realize, oh my God, I don't control the genes, they're controlling me. And I say, what is the net consequence of that thought? And the answer is this: I'm a victim of my heredity. Oh my God, there's cancer running in my family, I could get cancer, or there's cardiovascular disease and I'm next in line, I have the genes, I'm going to get cardiovascular disease. We're left with the impression of victim. I'm a victim of my heredity. And I go, 100% false. Let's just start with the first false thing. Genes are blueprints, just like in an architect's office. I go, why is it relevant? I said, go to an architect's office, and let's say she's reading a blueprint, and you ask her, is your blueprint on or off? And she'll look at you like, well, what are you, crazy? It's a blueprint. There's no on and off. I go, precisely. A gene is a blueprint. There is no on and off to it. I said, but then how does it work? I said, how does the blueprint work? I said, oh, there's an architect who reads the blueprint and can adjust that blueprint to build what they're building. I go, and I say, in the body, the genes are the blueprint, and consciousness is the architect. What are you building? What are you thinking? And this becomes, again, very important, because the new biology, which is called epigenetics, and let's make a quick distinction, when old belief system, this character is under genetic control. Genetic control means controlled by genes. This character is controlled by genes. I say, today we say this character is under epigenetic control. And you go, well, it sounds like the same thing. I say, no, epi means above. So when you say epigenetic control, what we're actually saying is control above the genes. I go, what's that? I go, mind. Mind is controlling your genes. I go, so what's the nature of the new epigenetics? I said, the genes don't control you. You control the genes. You control it based on your beliefs and your consciousness. And all of a sudden you realize how we've been programmed or our education, whatever it is shaping the experiences we're having in our body. When in truth, our consciousness is really responsible. And if you change consciousness, you've changed control of your genetics. And this is like how if somebody can have a spontaneous remission, they end up having a terminal cancer, but then realize, oh my God, my life is responsible for this cancer. And if I just change my life, and they change their life, and the cancer disappears. And it disappears because the cells are responding to the consciousness. Stress is the cause of cancer. There are no genes that cause cancer. Not one gene causes cancer. Genes are correlated with cancer. First the stress, then the cancer. So why is this relevant? And the answer is, are we victims of our genes? That's our belief. From that assumption, I go, no, you're masters of the gene. If you understood this, then the whole healthcare crisis could end tomorrow if we understood this. Okay. Number three and four assumptions that have taken us off track are based on Darwinian theory. The first understanding of Darwinian theory that throws us off is the belief that evolution is initiated by a random mutation, an accidental change in genetics. I go, oh. So I say, how did we get here? And I say, a whole series of accidents in genetics. And I go, so why is that relevant? I say, then why are we here? And all of a sudden the answer is, well, it's all a bunch of accidents. We're here by accident. I go, whoa, this is so wrong and so dangerous for the following reason. Evolution is based on adaptation. Organisms adjust their genetics to environmental needs. That when organisms work together in harmony, we call that a garden. And that's what we had before humans started to step outside of that garden and say, we're separate from the garden. Here's the garden. Humans are separate. And we can do any damn thing we want to that garden. And look what we've done. Our disconnection from nature has precipitated what scientists refer to as the sixth mass extinction of life. Five times in the history of this planet, life was thriving. Some catastrophic event wiped out up to 90% of life. Last time was about 66 million years ago when the dinosaurs were here. A comet hit in the Yucatan Peninsula and upended the entire ecosystem around the world, killed all the dinosaurs, killed up to 90% of life, and then life started all over again. So after 66 million years, here we are, life is thriving again, and now we're facing what is called the sixth mass extinction. And the difference is this. Previous ones were natural events, comets, tectonic plate movements, etc. The sixth mass extinction, which we are in, is due to human behavior. I go, why is it relevant? Because we're creating our own extinction by the way we have disconnected from nature. We didn't come here to dominate and control nature, which is a mission statement of science. We came here to live in harmony. The whole simple picture is this. Consider a garden is the height of cooperativity. And what we have done is brought a war into the garden and have been destroying the garden ever since. We're the ones that are not cooperating. So we have to change our belief system. We came here like the indigenous people of the world tell us we came here because we are gardeners to keep harmony and balance in a garden. And we have failed at that job. And as a result, facing now the sixth mass extinction. But since everything is based on consciousness, there's an opportunity to turn this baby around when we change consciousness. And finally, sorry for the long delay, but the last of the four assumptions that has taken us off track is, again, a Darwinian understanding referred to as survival of the fittest in the competition for life. I go, what the heck does that mean? It says, life is a struggle. That's what they say. Life is a struggle. And that evolution is based on how you can compete in that struggle. And I go, what does that mean? I go, well, we've created a world of winner loser where I'm competing against you. And okay, so there's a million Africans that are dying of starvation. Well, that's Darwinian, you know, that's their problem. It's just an, you know, they're just weaker and we're stronger over here. We got better gardens. It's like, wait a minute. that wasn't the mission statement to fight each other. The whole idea is to be in harmony with each other. It's completely wrong. Competition is wrong. As I said, a garden is cooperation. And we, as the fundamental elements, are affecting this. This is why it's called an anthropogenic situation, anthropogenic, human-created mass extinction. Because we have trampled nature, we're fighting with each other. And the reality is the only way out is to recognize the unity of people all around the world. And that all of us around the world recognize that we are here as part of gardening and keeping the beauty of what we inherited and unfortunately what we're destroying. So again, a major change of consciousness is needed as a result of that misperception. So we have four beliefs. The fact that, no, the universe is all energy. Number two, that we control our genes. Number three, that we didn't get here by accident. We're here as adaptation. And number four, that cooperation is the drive. If those new beliefs were installed into our civilization today, the garden would be here right now. And that's our opportunity to bring that back.
Beautiful. Time to come back into the garden here as good gardeners, huh, Bruce? Yeah, a lot of wisdom there. Thank you. Thank you very much. I'm gonna just come right at this next question. So, Bruce, how can we take control of our genetics, our health, our life experiences by exerting influence over the signals sent to our mind by our consciousness, beliefs, and emotions?
Well, the first thing we have to understand is what signals am I putting in my mind? Because remember, the mind is translated by the brain, which then creates a manifestation of the picture in our mind, health or disease, whatever the picture is, the mind's going to create it. I say, well, what are the signals I'm sending to the mind? So we have to step back for a second and just say, look, the brain is the interface between this consciousness and this body. And I go, the brain is a computer, and everyone's always said it. And I go, it is a computer. It's the best computer in the world, and maybe, you know, at this point, a universe, who knows? And I say, so why is it relevant? And I say, the brain is a computer. And I say, so what? And I go, if you go to the store and buy a brand new computer, you take it home, it's got an operating system. I say, yeah, you can push start. I say, so you start it up and then you got the screen turns on. And I say, now do something. And you go like, well, write, draw, do a spreadsheet, do something. I go, I can't. I say, why not? I didn't put any programs into the machine. So I have to download programs like MS Word or something like that. And I download these programs. And now I can use these programs to run my computer. So here's the point. When a child is in the last trimester of pregnancy, just last 3 months before birth, the operating system in the brain is turned on. Now the brain is in operation. But the question is, now you have to get programs. I go, well, how do you get programs put into the system? And the answer is this. What we observe in the world is downloaded as programs into the subconscious. If you observe wonderful, happy, loving things, so that those programs are downloaded. And if you observe strife, anger, and all that other kind of stuff, well, those programs are downloaded. And I go, so what? And I go, the first 7 years of a child's life, the brain is not predominantly in consciousness at all. First 7 years of a child's life, the brain is predominantly in a lower vibration. And that's when you measure brain's vibration, putting wires on a person's head called EEG, electroencephalograph. I can read your brain function. There are different vibrations. The lowest vibration is delta sleep. The next one's theta, which is characterized as imagination. Then next one higher is alpha, which is calm consciousness. And then the higher vibration in alpha is beta, which is like schoolroom thinking consciousness, okay? So I go, so what? And I say, when a child's born, and for the first 7 years, the predominant EEG, electrical activity of a child's brain, is not even in consciousness. It's a lower vibration called theta, which I said was imagination. And this is how kids can live in an imaginary world of drinking, tea party, pour nothing into the cup and drink it and go, well, that was the best tea I ever had in my life. And of course, that low calorie cake, it's on that plate and you could eat this invisible mud cake if you want. And it was like, that was the best cake you ever had. I go, this is theta operating, mixing real world and imagination. But theta is hypnosis. I go, so what's the relevance? I say, the computer of the brain operating system, 3 months before birth. From 3 months before birth to age 7, the operating system is operating at a lower vibration, theta, below consciousness, which is hypnosis. I go, why is it relevant? I say, how do you think you got programs to manage your life? I say, you didn't read a book and take, you didn't download any software. What you did was observe. You observed your mother, your father, your family, and community, and your observations were downloaded as behavior. You saw how they behaved, you recorded it, and that becomes a fundamental character of your behavior because that's the foundational program in your computer brain. I say, after age 7, you get to operate the computer. But here's the point. Most of these programs, since they're embedded, they're just automatic. How you relate to your family, how you relate to the community, you learn that by observing other people. So your behavior isn't coming from you. It's a download from those around you. And I go, so what's the relevance? I say, then your life from those programs is not controlled by you. It was controlled by what you observed. If your mother and father didn't have a great relationship, guess what? You're already off on the wrong trail because your program is bad relationship programming. And I go, so the point is this. You say, well, after age 7, I could be conscious, which is creative. I say, absolutely, you can. And so the monkey wrench now, big monkey wrench of the whole game is this. Consciousness is creative. I can think of the most wonderful world in the world. But I could also, operating my life with this consciousness. But here's the point. When you think, consciousness is not looking out. Consciousness is looking in. A thought is on the inside. So if I say, what are you doing on Sunday at 2:00? If you're going to answer that question, it's not in front of you. I say, where are you going to get the answer from? You're going to go, I'm thinking. I go, oh, consciousness, when it's thinking, is looking in. It's not looking out. I go, well, what if you're driving the car and you're thinking? I said, you're not watching the road. And I go, well, we do it all the time. I go, yeah, because here's the critical point. Subconscious is autopilot. When conscious is thinking, subconscious takes over the driving, but it will drive according to the program that it got. I go, so why is it relevant? And here's the conclusion. Only 5% of the day is conscious creativity controlling our wishes and our desires and what we want from life. Because 95% of the day, that's the amount of time consciousness is spent thinking, which then means 95% of the day, your life is not run by your wishes and desires. It's run by your programs, the majority of which are disempowering and limiting and self-sabotaging. So the important understanding here is very critical is that we are operating a computer. And if you've been programmed, and I'm going to say the 95% of your life is coming from that program, and most of that's negative, and then you go, last thing you would say, well, I wouldn't do a stupid program to sabotage myself. I go, you do not see the program when you are thinking. So let me close with this story that I've told for 30-some years in lectures, same one because there's not a better one yet. And that is simply this. I say you have a friend. You know your friend's behavior very, very well, and you know your friend's parent. And one day you see your friend has the exact same behavior as their parent, and you want to tell your friend. So you go, hey, Bill, you're just like your dad. And I said, back away from Bill. The moment you say that, Bill's going to say, how can you compare me to my dad? I'm nothing like my dad. And I go, this is the most profound story in the world. Most people have experienced. I said, what does it represent? I said, everyone else can see that Bill behaves like his dad. Only Bill does not see it and will say, I'm nothing like my dad. And everyone knows the behavior is exactly like his dad. And they laugh. And I go, but here's the problem. Why didn't Bill see it? I said, because 95% of the day, Bill is thinking and playing the program and while playing the program, not observing what's going on because he's observing what's going in. And as a result, doesn't see the behavior. And then the last concluding remark, Steve, before I jump off of this is we are all Bill. That's the problem. We are all doing the same thing. And that's why if our life isn't working out, we always think it's the outside is where the problem comes from, but not have owned. 95% of the day, you're playing behaviors that are probably sabotaging you. And like Bill, you don't see them. And all you see is the result. And then it looks like you're a victim because you didn't see that you were creating 95% of your life, not from your wishes and desires conscious, but from your programs in the subconscious.
Wow. Time to move from those unconscious programs to conscious programs, huh, Bruce?
Yes. Absolutely, right. Because it makes a difference, and I can swear to it because I never believed in it myself. But hey, for the last 20 plus years, heaven on earth, and it's not a coincidence.
Man, I see it. Okay, so Bruce, how do you participate in the unfolding of the simple two-step process that advances planetary evolution as we complete the third cycle of an upward evolutionary spiral? And maybe we can start with this third cycle of an upward evolutionary spiral, what that is.
Well, the first thing we have to understand is this: Darwinian evolutionary theory is incorrect. That is, it was always believed that genes control our characteristics and that humans with all the advanced characteristics would have 100,000 genes. And when they finally did the Human Genome Project and found only 20,000 genes, which is the same number of genes in primitive organisms, all of a sudden, the idea that more genes were necessary to create this is like, no, it wasn't more genes. It was more consciousness. And I say, why is it relevant? Because actually, the original theory of evolution 50 years before Darwin is now the most accurate. And that was from a guy called Lamarck. And if you haven't heard of Lamarck, you will in the near future, because this man back in 1809 published the first scientific theory of evolution, now the most accurate one, of how environment and organisms interact with each other and how nervous system is the score of evolution. When you go up the evolutionary tree from primitive to more advanced organisms, what you're seeing is not more genes, but you're seeing a more developed nervous system. And so I say, oh, so if you start to measure the nervous system and consciousness, then you can measure evolution. If you try to measure genes to see evolution, I say, well, that's a failure. There aren't any more genes. So it's more consciousness. And then all of a sudden it comes down to what the heck is consciousness? And the new biology reveals that the skin of the cell, the membrane, and I love it, membrane, the skin of cell is the nervous system of the cell. It is the brain of the cell. And there are units and built into the membrane called receptors, which are like eyes and ears and nose at a cellular level. And receptors see the world. Effectors take that signal from the world and then put it into the system to adjust the biology. So biology is always adjusting to environment around it through these little units, which are receptor effector proteins. I go, that's the fundamental unit of consciousness. And that they're called perceptions. And I go, so what's useful about it? I say, well, if you measure perceptions, then you're measuring consciousness. I go, well, great. Now let's measure the mathematics of it. It's built into the membrane. And all of a sudden I say, well, then measuring membrane surface, how much membrane you have, is measuring how much intelligence you have. And I go, so what? And I say, well, the first organisms, bacteria, only had a capsule, like an external skeleton. A capsule is what surrounds a bacterium cell. I say, why is it relevant? Because a bacterium cell can only get as big as what can fit in the capsule. And I say, well, how much membrane can you put in there? I say, well, there's a maximum amount. And all of a sudden you say, wait, Bruce, evolution is based on measuring membrane surface area. And the first thing you say is a bacterium lives in this little capsule and can only put so much membrane in it because it can only fit inside this capsule. I go, yeah. I say, so what? And I go, evolution stopped. When? When we made the smartest bacteria because I couldn't add any more membrane. You go, the end of evolution is bacteria? I go, no. There was phase two. First, make the smartest bacteria. Phase two, put the bacteria into community. And that was called biofilms. And biofilms were communities of bacteria that were sharing their effort to work together and surrounded by a membrane. I go, and I say, so what did that ultimately become? The community of bacteria became something we call the amoeba, which is a specialized community inside one cell. I go, oh, so smartest organism was a bacterium, then community of bacteria, But that led to the next level of evolution, amoeba. And I go, an amoeba has a membrane on the outside and a skeleton on the inside, so it could have 1,000 times more membrane than bacteria. And I go, so we could make a really smart amoeba. And I go, yeah, but there's a point where if you add too much membrane, the amoeba is like a balloon filled with too much water. It'll rupture and then it's dead. So I say, uh-oh. So then you can only get the smartest amoeba. And then if you made any more membrane, it would be fragile, wouldn't work. I go, yeah. So I say, evolution stopped with the smartest amoeba. I go, no, that was phase one, make the smartest individual. Phase two is put them together in a community. And I go, voila, a community of 50 trillion amoebas is a human. I go, wow. And I say, so what are humans? What are humans? Communities of amoebas sharing 50 trillion times the awareness of a single amoeba. And I go, wow, that's really cool. So phase one in that level was smartest amoeba, then the smartest community of amoebas. Then what? I say, but the smartest community calls a human. I go, yeah, so what? I say, well, what was the next point? The new organism, human, make the smartest one, phase one. I say, ah, again, another issue. You know what? The brain is like the bacterial cell. It's got a capsule called a skull. And you could only put so much brain inside that skull. In fact, in primitive organisms, the brain is just like a round thing inside the skull. But guess what? In a human, you start to look and you see all these folds called sulci and gyri. The brain is all folded up in flattened layers. I go, why are all the folds? I say, if you spread out the surface of the brain, surface area, it's massive. I go, oh, so a human can only be so smart, because that's how much brain you can put in a human. And then I say, phase two, repeat, take the single entity, make a community out of it, and then create something new. And in our case, where are we? We've already created the smartest human. That was thousands and thousands of years ago. But since then, we have come together in community to do what? Create the ultimate community, our destination, a new organism called humanity, where we are cells, each one of us, in the body of the same organism. So every human on earth is a cell in the same body. And if we start to treat each other as, hey, we're all in this together as a giant community to create this new organism, that is our evolutionary destination to create a whole new intelligence on planet Earth called a humanity. Oh, humanity's team. There they are. Okay.
All right. We'll leave it right there. That's a beautiful beautiful place to leave it, Bruce. Thank you. Bruce, can you share what the new emerging story of evolution means for our life and how to best use this newfound understanding to advance our own evolution and the evolution of our whole species?
Yes, it's a biphasic, and at the level three, I said there are three levels. Start with bacterium to biofilm. Level two, amoeba to human. Level three, human to humanity. And so this biphasic, two phases, I said we already done phase one. We're right now breaking down the structure of this system. And I say very simple analogy, straightforward and beautiful, and that is this. A caterpillar is a very destructive organism in the sense that you put a caterpillar, let's say like a monarch butterfly caterpillar, on a milkweed plant and come back in a day or so, all the leaves would be, the milkweed plant would be just stems and no leaves. It was voracious and ate all the leaves. So it really is quite destructive of its environment. But once all the leaves are eaten, the caterpillar goes into something called a pupa or a chrysalis inside. And when that opens up, a butterfly comes out, and the butterfly is the light touch population. A butterfly is gliding over it and doesn't even, you know, not a voracious appetite or nothing. It's a very light touch organism. I go, well, how did it work? I say, well, first the caterpillar is, let's just say you're a cell in a caterpillar, and there's a billion citizens inside the body of this caterpillar making it grow and eating and building and building. And then I say, you reach an end where it doesn't work anymore. And you fold yourself up, and then the caterpillar breaks down. As the cells break down, they then become reorganized to create the new organism called the butterfly. And when the pupa opens up, a whole new organism pops out, the light touch one. Human civilization's in caterpillar move right now. We have destroyed the environment just like caterpillars do. I say, what happens? I say, it can't do this anymore. It ends. It ends now. Why? We're destroying the planet. We're going to end if we don't stop right now. I say, then what? You break down the structure because the old version is destructive of everything. The caterpillar body is now no longer sustainable at this moment. So I say, okay, civilization and voracious caterpillar now recognize you can't do this anymore. Break down the structure. And I go, hey, welcome to the breakdown. We're in the breakdown of a structure that's not sustainable. I say, why is it relevant? Because the cells, us, are going to reorganize into a different form. The light touch, the equivalent of the butterfly. When we come out of this transition into a new civilization, the new evolution, so to speak, we will start to recognize how we are here not to destroy this garden like we've been doing. We're here to enhance this garden. And so where are we now? We're in a chrysalis, and the breakdown that you see is required, because if it doesn't break down, the system is going to kill itself, which it's doing right now. And so when you see the upheaval, the chaos, when you see it, at least through my eyes, when you see it, you go, all right, this is great. Why? Because this means we're moving from here to someplace better. And then instead of focusing on what's coming down, we move over here and focus on building something much better. And a new civilization is in process. Will it make it? Look, we've been here before, you know, and it didn't. But I think this time around, with global communication and integration of the entire world's population, the transformation of the civilization into the butterfly equivalent is in process right now, and own a very simple reality. The chaos you see is required. If it didn't occur, we were on a collision course with extinction. And so don't be afraid of what's going on. In fact, we should be out there welcoming what's going on, because it means we're moving into a new civilization.
Yes, we are. We're coming back into the garden, so to speak, using some of the metaphor you've been bringing in, Bruce. Thank you. And,